Legalists at the ECB would argue that the central bank's mandate gave it only one objective, price stability. They could derive from that an obligation to maintain the functioning of Europe's financial markets and Europe's banks. And Trichet would thus justify his interference in Greek and Irish affairs and more to come. What the ECB did not have was a mandate to concern itself with the economic welfare of the Eurozone or its member states in any broader sense. It was a willfully simplistic and conservative interpretation. It was ruinous for the Eurozone. The crisis would begin to be overcome only when the ECB began to step beyond it. The Fed never took such a narrow view. It had a mandate both to preserve price stability and to maximize employment. This was a legacy bequeathed by the more broad-gauge economic policy debate of the 1970s, but it was anchored deep in the Fed's organizational DNA by the memory of the Great Depression. The deflationary misery of the 1930s was the defining event in the Fed's history. That was the history that Bernanke had pledged not to repeat. In 2010, the United States had survived the worst of its crisis, but it was far from fully recovered. The housing market was still in shock. The percentage of outstanding mortgages in foreclosure proceedings was heading toward a grim record over the winter of 2010 to 2011 at 4.64%, more than 2 million homes. Since early in 2010, Bernanke had been sounding the alarm about an excessive tightening of fiscal policy. On the afternoon of November 3rd, the day after the dramatic midterm congressional elections, the Fed announced its response. After an intense internal debate, the Federal Open Market Committee resolved to begin purchasing securities at the rate of $75 billion per month for the next 8 months. QE2 had arrived. How exactly quantitative easing works remains a subject of controversy. Large-scale purchasing of mainly short-term bonds drives up bond prices and thus reduces yields. Reduced short-term rates may help to lever down long-term rates and thus to stimulate investment. But that depends on there being businesses willing to invest, which cannot be taken for granted at a time of crisis. The most direct effect of QE comes via financial markets. As the central bank hoovers up bonds, it drives down yields, forcing asset managers to go in search of yields in other classes of assets. Switching out of bonds into stocks inflates the stock market, increasing the wealth of those with stock portfolios, tending to make them more willing to both invest and consume. This, to say the least, is an uncertain and indirect method of stimulating the economy. By boosting the wealth of already wealthy households, it is predestined to increase inequality. Low-income households have no way of participating in capital gains. QE was never anything other than an emergency expedient adopted by the Fed in light of the fiscal policy logjam in Congress. But the Fed itself was not insulated from the polarization of American politics. The FOMC vote on QE2 was split three ways. A vocal minority argued that the stimulus should have been much larger. The markets had already priced in a QE2 announcement at $75 billion. To have a substantial impact, the Fed needed to deliver a surprise. Bernanke demurred. He did not want to stray too far beyond the sense of normality, because to do so might in fact stoke a mood of anxiety and thus be counterproductive. As Bernanke put it at the meeting to critics on the board, "There is no safe thing to do. I'd like to frame our discussion today as a very conservative, middle-road approach. Namely, we recognize that doing nothing carries serious risks of further disinflation and of a failure of the recovery to meet escape velocity." On the FOMC, there were also two votes objecting to QE2 not on the grounds that it was inadequate, but because it was too expansionary. Beyond the Fed's walls, the reactions were more intemperate. In the superheated political climate of the Republican election triumph of November 2010, what hogged the headlines was the news that the Fed was embarking on a plan to print tens of billions of dollars every month. On the part of the conspiratorial right wing, Bernanke's intervention reinforced the conviction that dark forces were at work. Glenn Beck warned his millions of Republican viewers on Fox that they should not be deceived by their congressional victory. The actual reins of power were held by liberal inflationists. What threatened America was a hyperinflationary Weimar moment. Meanwhile, a prominent list of conservative intellectuals, including, once again, historian Neil Ferguson and Amity Schles of the Council on Foreign Relations, joined Sarah Palin in calling on the Fed to cease and desist. Significantly, they pointed out that the Fed's purchase program has also met broad opposition from other central banks across the world. This was no exaggeration. After 18 months of wrangling at the G20 over fiscal policy, QE2 produced an open rift over monetary policy. This was predictable, but it was not necessary. The two agenda-setting innovations of October and November of 2010, the Mercosy PSI agenda of Deauville and Bernanke's QE2, could have been complementary. As Chopra of the IMF had laid out, the ideal accompaniment for aggressive debt restructuring in Ireland would have been an ECB bond purchasing program designed to insulate the other fragile members of the Eurozone from the fallout. A push for PSI and bond market intervention were both responses to the inadequacy of the course embarked upon in Greece in May 2010. But in the Eurozone, the two never joined hands. Instead, rather than seeing QE as the necessary accompaniment to a more sustainable resolution of the Eurozone debt crisis, Berlin's conservatives led the international front against monetary experiments. The Fed announced QE2 only days before President Obama and his team departed for the latest G20 summit, this time in Seoul. There they met unprecedented criticism. In the words of one of the U.S. Treasury officials who ran the gauntlet, Seoul was a bleep show. The Brazilians, as the putative leaders of the left wing of the emerging markets, inveighed against the risks of hot money and accused Bernanke of a beggar-thy-neighbor devaluation of the dollar. They warned of a currency war. For the Chinese, the Fed's action was a sign that the United States does not recognize its obligation to stabilize capital markets, as Zhu Guangyao, China's vice finance minister, put it. Nor does it take into consideration the impact of this excessive fluidity on the financial markets of emerging countries. Wolfgang Schäuble went furthest. Once more, America had revealed itself as an agent of global economic disorder. First, it had created the fiasco of Lehman. Then it had championed stimulus. Now the Fed was monetizing public debt. As the G20 convened, the German finance minister denounced American economic policy as clueless and as likely to increase the insecurity of the world economy. The Fed's policies made a reasonable balance between industrial and developing countries more difficult, and they undermined the credibility of the U.S. in finance policymaking. Whereas Germany had stuck with its model of export success that did not need exchange rate tricks, the American growth model was, according to Schäuble, in a deep crisis. The Americans have lived for too long on credit, overblown their financial sector, and neglected their industrial base. The Americans did not go down without a fight. Tim Geithner countered that the real source of imbalances in the world economy was not U.S. monetary policy, but the mercantilist trade policies of China and Germany. The Fed was not deliberately depreciating the dollar. It was targeting domestic conditions, not the exchange rate. If others wanted to prevent their currencies from appreciating, all they had to do was to match the Fed's low interest rate policy with an expansion of their own. What the critics dubbed a currency war could thus have been turned into a comprehensive program of monetary expansion, countering the slide into a double-dip recession not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. If they didn't choose to join the stimulus, then all they had to do was to allow their currencies to appreciate, which, as Washington had been preaching since the early 2000s, would restore balance naturally. It was Germany's export dependence and China's determination to peg its currency that put the United States in charge. If they wanted to free ride on American aggregate demand, they should at least have the grace to do so quietly. If there were grievances, Geithner suggested, why not agree to allow the IMF to resume the project begun before the crisis of monitoring and overseeing international imbalances, not only America's deficit, but China's and Germany's surpluses as well? But that was a non-starter. Germany would never admit that its trade surplus was anything other than a reward for its competitiveness and productive virtue. The back and forth had the effect only of producing a dizzying moment of unreality. While tens of millions were without work, and the European welfare state was hollowed out at the behest of the Troika, Fox News terrorized its viewers with images of Ben Bernanke as a sorcerer's apprentice unleashing Weimar-style hyperinflation, and Germany's finance minister denounced a proposal by the US Treasury Secretary as reminiscent of the bad old days of Soviet-style economic planning. While Berlin denounced QE as a source of instability, Europe's banks took a very different view. For every $1 billion worth of securities the Fed purchased, it credited an account with a corresponding amount of dollars. But who was it that held those dollar accounts with the Fed and thus funded QE? As the Fed's statistics show, it was not America's banks that took advantage of QE to unload large portfolios of bonds or to hold cash, though some American pension funds and mutual funds did sell bonds to the Fed. The banks most actively involved in QE2 were not American, but European, running down their U.S. securities portfolios and building up Fed cash balances. From November 2010, there is a near one-for-one identity between the expansion of the Federal Reserve balance sheet and the expansion of dollar cash balances held by non-US banks with the Fed. This would suggest that, far from the Fed increasing the insecurity of the world economy, it was, in effect, acting as the world's piggy bank. As the Eurozone stumbled back toward crisis, Europe's banks abandoned the standstill agreement of May 2010. They shifted money out of Europe, shrank their U.S. operations, deleveraged their balance sheets, and built up a huge pile of cash. Thanks to QE2, they held that liquidity reserve not with the ECB, but with the ultimate guarantor of the global financial system, the Fed. It was not a recipe for economic expansion, but in the absence of any solution to the Eurozone crisis, it did at least promise a cushion of stability. Chapter 16. G-Zero World. The commitment to austerity in 2010 drove critical economists to impatient fury. Why was the world embarked on a course that was so self-evidently counterproductive and so damaging to the prospects of tens of millions of unemployed around the world? Whose interests were being served by preserving this reserve army? Paul Krugman asked in the New York Times. Whose interests were served by a lopsided deficit debate in which minor tax increases were traded for huge cuts in entitlements? What kind of shock would it take to break this impasse? Historical experience was not encouraging. FDR's New Deal had not been enough. It had been hobbled by its own timidity and by relentless opposition from the right. To unleash the full capacities of the American state, it had taken the national emergency of a war. The fact is, Krugman insisted, the Great Depression ended largely thanks to a guy named Adolf Hitler. He created a human catastrophe, which also led to a lot of government spending. That didn't mean that Krugman was hoping for World War III, but he couldn't resist telling Playboy magazine that if it were announced that we faced a threat from space aliens and needed to build up to defend ourselves, we'd have full employment in a year and a half. In light of events in 2011, one can't help wondering whether Krugman assumed too much coherence in 21st century politics. The year, in fact, began with a geopolitical earthquake, the Arab Spring. And true to Krugman's script, this triggered military intervention and calls for a Marshall Plan for the Middle East. But after Afghanistan and Iraq, there was no appetite anywhere in the West for nation-building in foreign lands. Among conservative commentators, alarm at the overthrow of friendly Arab dictators mixed with the dismayed reaction to Bernanke's QEs to form a heady cocktail. A Wall Street Journal op-ed drew comparisons to the 1970s, when global inflation had helped to trigger the fall of the Shah and Khomeini's revolution in Iran. Now, by printing money and driving up commodity prices, it was the Fed's QE program that was destabilizing the world. As the Tunisian and Egyptian dictatorships toppled, conservative social media activists urged their followers to tweet, "Bernanke has blood on his hands." Meanwhile, the liberal press fired back. It wasn't monetary policy that was responsible for high commodity prices and food riots. It was global warming. That riposte allowed Paul Krugman to equate conservative opposition to quantitative easing to climate change denial. It wasn't so much a serious debate about the Arab Spring as indicative of the increasingly unhinged quality of American political discourse. Europe was closer to the North African drama, but its reaction was hardly more coherent. France, Britain, and Germany fell out over the NATO intervention in Libya, with Germany siding, as it had done at the Seoul G20, with China and Russia. Merkel's government refused to give its vote in the UN Security Council for the aerial campaign against Gaddafi. Meanwhile, the EU squabbled disgracefully about who should accommodate the desperate refugees and migrants who poured through Libya into Italy. It was a dispiriting accompaniment to the rolling crisis in the Eurozone. In the summer of 2011, it was not only the stability of Middle Eastern regimes, but the creditworthiness of Italy and the United States that would be placed in doubt. Little wonder, perhaps, that two acute observers of the contemporary scene should refer to the world in 2011 as being governed not so much by the G20, G8, or G2, but by G0. By the spring of 2011, austerity was biting deep into the social fabric of Europe. Spending cuts and tax increases were slashing demand and squeezing economic activity. Across the Eurozone, 10% of the workforce were unemployed. But unemployment for those between the ages of 15 and 24 was 20%. And on the troubled periphery, the numbers were numbing in scale. In Ireland, general unemployment reached 15% and youth unemployment 30%. In Greece, 14% and 37% respectively. In Spain, 20% of all adults and 44% of young people were unemployed by the summer of 2011. Half a generation had their launch out of education and into working life aborted. Nevertheless, the demand for further austerity was unrelenting. After Ireland and Greece had subordinated themselves to Troika programs, on March 23, 2011, Portugal's Prime Minister, José Sócrates, resigned after failing to gain support for budget cuts. A week later, on April 2, Spain's Social Democratic Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, announced that he would not run for re-election and would prioritize stabilizing Spain's finances. On April 7, Portugal became the third country to place itself under a Troika program. The sense that Europe's welfare state was being subjected to a relentless program of rollback, driven by the demands of bankers and bond markets, provoked outrage. Stéphane Hessel, former French resistance fighter and ecological activist, survivor of Buchenwald, Dora, and Bergen-Belsen, became an unlikely best-selling author with his well-timed manifesto, Indignez-vous. Time for outrage. To oppose the demands of global finance, Hessel summoned the spirit of resistance martyr Jean Moulin, who died in 1943 at the hands of the Gestapo. Taking up Hessel's slogan on May 15, 2011, ahead of local elections, a crowd of 20,000 Spanish protesters occupied the most symbolic square in Madrid, the Puerta del Sol. The indignados would remain there for a month, defying efforts by the police and courts to evict them. Building a tenth city, they declared that "we are not goods in the hands of politicians and bankers." And the M15 movement continued long after their original camp was dispersed. June 19, 2011, witnessed the largest wave of demonstrations in Spain's tumultuous modern history, bringing perhaps as many as 3 million people, 7% of the Spanish population, onto the streets. Scaled to the size of the United States, the equivalent demonstration would have involved 19 million protesters. Among the more humorous Spanish chants was one directed at Greece, their partners in austerity. "Hush, the Greeks are sleeping." In 2010, Greece had been rocked by massive protests, but since the fall, resistance in Greece had ebbed. On May 28, 2011, Athens answered the Spanish challenge and the latest round of cuts demanded by the Troika with the occupation of Syntagma Square. A week later, June 5th, saw a gigantic rally with between 200,000 and 300,000 participants in the capital city. Syntagma would be cleared only after violent clashes on June 28th and 29th, pitting revolutionary militants against riot police, many of whom made no secret of their sympathy for Greece's neo-fascist Golden Dawn movement. A resurgent nationalism, defending sovereignty against the impositions of the crisis, would be one of the most powerful political responses to the crisis. This had both left and right-wing variants. Both were at their most vocal in Greece, where the diktat of the Troika awakened memories of occupation, civil war, and dictatorship. On the left, it was commonplace in the demonstrations of 2010 and 2011 to associate Germany's veto over Eurozone economic policy with Nazi imperialism. Meanwhile, Greece's own fascists paraded openly in the streets. The membership of the Golden Dawn Party reveled in torch-lit processions, adorned with runic flags and shielded by heavily muscled stormtroopers. Golden Dawners harassed and attacked leftists and non-European immigrants while laying on soup kitchens, reserved, of course, only for hungry Greeks. In a textbook rerun of the 1930s, a comprehensive social and economic crisis provided the setting for a program of national racial community. The modes of resistance produced by the crisis were significant in their own right. Marches, demonstrations, and strikes were combined with encampments, claiming territory. Public spaces, manicured and modernized beyond recognition during the boom years, were reclaimed for an alternative mode of life. In Greece, defiance of the Troika took the form of the non-payment of taxes and fines. In Spain, with 500,000 families facing eviction and a life crushed under unpayable debts, there is no bankruptcy protection for mortgage debtors under Spanish law, protesters specialized in new forms of non-violent, direct confrontation. So-called escraches brought flash mobs together, organized via social media, to get in the faces of politicians, forcing the unresponsive elite to acknowledge the scale and intensity of the emergency. If markets were entitled to panic, why should citizens be expected to preserve a proper demeanour? Why was it only the confidence of investors that mattered? The new left that began to take shape in response to the Eurozone crisis would in due course shake up European politics. In Greece, the coalition of the radical left, known as Syriza, a combination of anti-globalization movements and breakaway elements of the Communist Party that had first formed 10 years earlier, positioned itself under its charismatic young leader, Alexis Tsipras, as the radical alternative to PASOK, as the party willing to lead the Greek people in their struggle against oligarchs at home and the Troika in Brussels. In Spain, the ranks of the protesters of 2011 included the articulate professor of political sociology and left-wing talk show host Pablo Iglesias, who would go on to be the main mover behind the Podemos party that was founded in 2014. Like Syriza, Podemos activists freely invoked the language of the people to bind together a broad-based coalition against the government's austerity line. Podemos championed the cause of la gente against la casta, the corrupt clique bent on stealing democracy from the people. Greek and Spanish politics would never be the same again. The crisis had leaped from the financial to the political sphere. But in the spring of 2011, the protests were held at arm's length by the incumbent governments. What forced a change in policy was not protest, however passionate and imaginative, but the inescapable realization that extend and pretend, the fix cobbled together in 2010, simply did not work. Greece's situation was deteriorating. It was implementing austerity, but the debt-to-GDP burden was rising, not falling. Cutting government expenditure did not have the energizing effect on private business activity that the advocates of expansionary austerity imagined, but rather the reverse. Consumer spending and investment plummeted. As demand collapsed, this led to further job losses and declining tax revenues. By the early summer of 2011, it was clear that Greece would not be able to access capital markets in 2012 as had been assumed. This meant that the Europeans would have to come up with further loans or find some way of reducing Greece's obligations ahead of the 2013 deadline. The IMF would not continue to disburse money into a program that was not fully funded. 1 year on from the crisis of the spring of 2010, patience was running out in Berlin too. At a G7 meeting on April 14th, after Strauss-Kahn had set out the IMF's terms, Schäuble weighed in. "We cannot just buy out the private investors with public money," he admonished. Merkel's coalition was fragile. The FDP was, frankly, Eurosceptic. The SPD, if it was to vote with Merkel on Europe, demanded that the bondholders must be burned. But the EU Commission and the French government demurred, and Trichet would stop at nothing to keep restructuring off the agenda. When, on April 6th, the Greeks formally requested a discussion of reprofiling, restructuring the debt not by reducing the amounts owed, but by extending the period of payment and the interest owed, Trichet forced them back into line by threatening to cut off the Greek banks. The ECB's position was not purely negative. What Trichet wanted was for the national governments to take over the task of bond market stabilization that the ECB had undertaken since May 2010. The European Financial Stability Facility, agreed among the European governments on May 10, 2010, had begun operating. It was the vehicle for the bailout loans to Ireland and Portugal. But its legal status was fragile. Its funding was on a voluntary and bilateral basis. And it was to be used only in emergencies to buy up new debt issued by states shut out of the capital markets. It was not authorized to do the job that had been offloaded on the ECB, buying bonds in the secondary market to stabilize prices and yields. For Merkel to designate a common European fund for bond market stabilization was political poison, because it smacked of debt mutualization, with all the political and legal ramifications that entailed. The Bundesbank might not like the ECB's bond buying, but it could be justified as routine central bank intervention. To let Trichet carry the can was the lesser of two evils, as far as Merkel was concerned. This was the basic inconsistency in the German position. Berlin was not just the relentless advocate of austerity. It was also the most consistent and clear-headed on restructuring and PSI. But when it came to its necessary concomitants, starting with backstopping the rest of the bond market, Berlin was inconsistent and incoherent. Nor did Berlin show any particular energy in recapitalizing its banks, allowing Hypo Real Estate and the weaker Landesbanken to become millstones around its neck. Bailing in creditors without backstopping the bond market and strengthening the banks was not so much responsible policy as a high-wire act that the ECB, the French, and the Americans all regarded with horror. And this is the most charitable interpretation of Berlin's motivations. The less charitable reading was that Germany was engaged in a strategy of tension, deliberately fostering market uncertainty to bully the rest of the Eurozone into submission. Meanwhile, Germany enjoyed the privileges of a safe haven. While the pigs groaned under rising yields, Germany's interest rates were sliding inexorably toward the zero lower bound. The uncertainty in the Eurozone was not good for export business, but Germany's exports to the rest of the world were booming. Labor markets were tightening. It was a long way from the affluence and complacency of Munich or Frankfurt to the turbulent streets of Madrid and Athens. Berlin could afford to wait it out. It was Trichet and his colleagues at the ECB who found the status quo unacceptable. As a result of months of bond buying, by the spring of 2011, they found themselves as proud owners of 15% of Greece's junk-rated public debt. When further negotiations about the European Stability Mechanism, the permanent replacement for the EFSF, did not provide for the purchasing of bonds in the secondary market, the ECB's patience ran out. It was time for Frankfurt to draw the line. The public side of the ECB's new, harder stance was interest rate policy. As the Eurozone crisis heated up again in April and July 2011, the ECB, in one of the most misguided decisions in the history of monetary policy, raised rates. In the ECB's defense, it was true that inflation in Germany and other hotspots of the Eurozone economy was picking up. The asymmetry between the relative prosperity of Northern Europe and the rest of Europe was all too real. But the ECB's move was clearly intended as a political signal. The ECB was asserting its independence. It was putting Europe's governments on notice. It would be up to them to take responsibility for the debt markets. Nor were interest rates the only way to send the message. Without fanfare, indeed without public announcement of any kind, in mid-March the European Central Bank stopped purchases of Eurozone sovereign bonds and introduced differentiated haircuts on repos for lower-rated bonds. It took a few weeks for the markets to register the serious tightening of credit conditions. Then they sold off. The yield spread between the safest and riskiest Eurozone bonds surged. The Greek spread reached 1,200 points, and this time the fear was different. In 2010, the markets had moved against individual countries, first Greece, then Ireland. Now a wall of money was moving against the Eurozone as a whole. One key indicator was American money market funds, key contributors to the cash pools from which European banks sourced their funding, huge sources of liquidity managed by giant asset managers like BlackRock. Whereas in early 2011 they were still providing as much as $600 billion in funding to European banks, from the spring they drastically curtailed their exposure. Over the course of the year, they would reduce their commitment to European banks by 45%. French banks were particularly hard hit. Even giants like BNP were not exempt. On Wall Street, large bets were now being placed not just on the default of the weakest borrowers. By the spring, S&P was reckoning with a 50-70% haircut on Greek debt and a 1-in-3 chance of outright disorderly default. Increasingly, investors were betting on the collapse of the euro itself. The most aggressive hedge fund managers swung their money first one way, then the other, betting against the dollar on the back of the ECB's interest rate increase, and then the other way, taking huge positions against European sovereigns, banks, and other vulnerable stock. Big Wall Street names like Bond King Bill Gross at PIMCO and John Paulson, the hedge fund hero of 2008, let it be known that they were bearish on Europe. They had always been skeptical about the Eurozone, admittedly, but with the ECB and the national governments at odds, the Europeans seemed bent on self-destruction, and there was money to be made on that, too. Nor was it only American money that was signalling its lack of confidence. A huge internal movement of funds within the Eurozone was afoot. This was registered in a previously obscure but soon-to-be-notorious appendage of the Eurosystem known as the Target 2 balances. As money flowed out of bank accounts in Greece, Ireland, Spain, and Portugal in search of safety, it moved to Germany and elsewhere in the core Eurozone. If funding markets had been functioning normally, the stressed peripheral banks would have found replacement funding in interbank markets without troubling their central banks. The recipient banks in the North were, after all, flush with flight money, and their Greek counterparts were willing to offer good rates. But interbank lending in Europe had never recovered from the shocks of 2007 and 2008, and had been dealt a further blow in the panic of April 2010. So instead, peripheral banks drew their funding from their national central banks, which, because they were no longer sovereign issues of domestic currency, drew their euros from the ECB headquarters in Frankfurt, while at the same time the Bundesbank and other recipients of flight money piled up credits. Suddenly, in the spring of 2011, thanks largely to the journalistic entrepreneurship of the economist Professor Hans Werner Zinn, the German public was alerted to the shocking and quite misleading news that they were secretly providing a huge credit to the periphery. Hundreds of billions of euros would be forfeited if the currency system collapsed. This alarmist interpretation of the accounting data should be seen less as a piece of economic analysis than as a symptom of the increasing loss of legitimacy on the part of the euro system. What the Target 2 balances registered was not a loan by Germany to the rest of the system. The Target 2 balances were the offsetting official counterpart to an enormous movement of private funds into German bank accounts from the eurozone periphery. Some of those moving funds were rich Greek or Spanish businesses, but in large part it was Germany's own investors bringing their euros home. They were able to do so without risk of currency losses or a massive Deutschmark appreciation, which would have hurt Germany's exporters, thanks to the monetary union and the ECB's clearing system. Zinn liked to inflame his readers with dark scenarios in which a breakup of the euro resulted in a loss of Germany's bookkeeping claims on the ECB. It was a grim and uncertain prospect, but one thing was certain. The funds that anxious investors had already moved to safety in Germany were very unlikely to leave. What Germany was benefiting from was something akin to the exorbitant privilege enjoyed by the United States in the global economy. At times of stress, global money moved into dollars. In the eurozone, money moved to Germany. It was a privilege measured by the yield spread. As the yields on crisis country bonds soared, those on Bunds eased. It was one of the factors that helped to feed Germany's prosperity bubble. That a flow of funds into Germany should come to be seen as a burden was symptomatic of the feverish discourse of the crisis. By May 2011, confidence was so shaky that a secret Eurogroup meeting was hurriedly convened in Luxembourg. Scheduled for Friday, May 6th, it was meant to restore unity and coherence. Instead, it turned into a PR disaster. When Schäuble insisted that they must start by discussing restructuring and PSI, Trichet stormed out. He wouldn't countenance such talk. On the other hand, to proceed without him was impractical, as the only thing keeping the Greek banks alive was ECB support. No one fancied the idea of having to restructure them, too. When Der Spiegel got wind of the meeting and markets in the United States began to react, the spokesman for Jean-Claude Juncker, the veteran Prime Minister of Luxembourg and Eurogroup chair, flatly denied that any meeting was taking place. Hours later, the same spokesman was forced to admit that the leaders had indeed met. "There was a very good reason to deny that the meeting was taking place," he told the assembled journalists. "We had Wall Street open at that point in time." The euro was plunging. Lying was a matter of self-preservation. When the Wall Street Journal asked whether such deception might undermine the market's confidence in future eurozone pronouncements, Juncker's spokesman retorted that the market already appeared to discount any comments by ECB President Trichet and France's Finance Minister Lagarde. Whatever they said on the subject of Greece's debt, nobody seems to believe it. So what further harm could be done by a convenient lie? Juncker himself had come to similarly stark conclusions. "Monetary policy is a serious issue," the Eurogroup chair told an audience in April. "We should discuss this in secret, in the Eurogroup. If we indicate possible decisions, we are fueling speculations on the financial markets, and we are throwing in misery mainly the people we are trying to safeguard from this. I am for secret, dark debates. I'm ready to be insulted as being insufficiently democratic, but I want to be serious. When it becomes serious, you have to lie." By May 2011, the effort to defend the indefensible, to uphold, extend and pretend, had resulted in a complete breakdown of credible and coherent communication about the eurozone's economic policy. Juncker was unusual only for feeling that he didn't need to dress it up, which, as far as a tiny bourgeois tax haven like Luxembourg was concerned, might have been true. Projected onto a larger stage of the EU, the implications of Juncker's realism were rather more disconcerting. With Europe's credibility draining away, what was needed was a reset, a clarifying intervention that would restore credibility and stop the crisis of confidence from widening. This is what Dominique Strauss-Kahn, as head of the IMF, seems to have had in mind when he scheduled meetings first with Angela Merkel and then with the Eurogroup for mid-May 2011. Strauss-Kahn was going to push for a big firewall, recalled one senior U.S. official. We were putting a considerable amount of expectation on the outcome of those meetings. Inside the IMF, a new head of steam of opposition to Extend and Pretend was building. The Funds Ireland team had never been satisfied with the inequitable deal forced on Dublin by the ECB and the G7 in November 2010. Ireland's problems, Ajay Chopra insisted, were not merely Irish in scope. They are a shared European problem that required joint European action. What was needed was to beef up the EFSF, giving it more resources and wider authority to intervene. Furthermore, as Ireland showed, Europe's banks were too big to bail by any but the largest states. So Chopra insisted that if banks could not raise enough capital from private sources, there should be coordinated recapitalization across the EU. Already a year earlier, in March 2010, Strauss-Kahn had challenged the Europeans to establish a jointly funded bank resolution authority. Without that, any steps toward major debt restructuring were dangerous to contemplate. By May 2011, the IMF had clearly formulated the basic logic of a Eurozone fix that went beyond Extend and Pretend, and Strauss-Kahn seems to have been bent on delivering it. But minutes before his departure from JFK on May 14th, the managing director of the IMF was hauled off his flight by officers of the NYPD to face charges of sexual assault and unlawful imprisonment. It was a bewildering turn of events. Much of European opinion was in uproar at the spectacle of such a prominent figure being reduced to the indignity of a New York perp walk. Did the presumption of innocence not hold in America? In France, those who did not blame the Americans blamed Sarkozy, who was widely suspected of plotting to eliminate Strauss-Kahn as a rival for the presidency. Meanwhile, the hope that the IMF might shake the Eurozone out of its paralysis evaporated, and the fund was left without a managing director. The question of succession opened a sore wound. In 2007, the emerging markets had been promised that the next head of the IMF would be one of theirs. Now, faced with the Eurozone crisis, it was argued that because the IMF was so deeply engaged in Europe, it was crucial to have a European at the helm. Had Latin Americans, Asians, or Africans ever had the temerity to make the analogous case, one can only imagine the reaction. The Europeans didn't even blink. Their candidate for the job was Christine Lagarde, who had proven both her loyalty and her competence as Sarkozy's finance minister. She had the backing of Europe, the United States, and China. Meanwhile, as the Eurozone spiraled toward crisis, the IMF's push for decisive action was aborted. While Lagarde readied herself for her new role, the helm was taken by John Lipsky, the IMF's American number two. Lipsky was all for large-scale support actions in the interest of systemic stability. If there were to be private sector involvement, on the other hand, it would have to be voluntary and modest in scale. The priority of systemic stability and preventing contagion reasserted itself. This was no time for dangerous talk about debt restructuring or bank recapitalization. What mattered was containing the crisis and preventing uncertainty spreading from Europe. Strauss-Kahn never made it to his discussion with Merkel. But on June 5th, the German Chancellor headed to Washington. By inclination, Merkel was an Atlanticist. But not since 2003 had relations been so strained. On economic policy, Germany and America had been out of step since the crisis began. The storm of a QE2 had been embarrassing. And where had Germany been in Libya? What was Berlin's plan for Europe? The discussions with Obama were intense. Merkel returned home on June 8th with a Presidential Medal of Freedom and a new tune. There would be no more talk of Greek default or Grexit. In exchange for further austerity from Greece, there would be another aid package. Private sector involvement, that is, debt restructuring, would be part of the bargain, as Germany had wanted from the start. But it would be voluntary. It would be a creditor-led restructuring, with the banks exercising a veto over the manner and scale of the debt write-down. What was still missing from Berlin's pronouncements was any bold plan for a European bond fund or recapitalization. The net effect, therefore, was to heighten the tension. What the markets heard was that there would be PSI, but without an adequate safety net. On June 29th, the battered Greek government pushed the fourth round of austerity through Parliament, including privatization, tax increases, and pension cuts. It did so in the wake of the violent clearance of Syntagma Square occupation and a two-day general strike. It did so in the face of IMF calculations that suggested that to achieve debt sustainability, Greece needed to sell off public assets to the tune of 50 billion euros. Indeed, according to a further IMF assessment released on July 4th, even that would not be enough. It would take not only austerity and privatization, but a truly heavy bondholder haircut to get Greece to sustainability. The tone of the talks with the International Institute of Finance, IIF, which had begun on June 27th, suggested that there was little prospect of that. The banks and other bondholders were making only modest concessions. That suited the ECB, which was desperate that there should be no default event. But it stood in jarring contrast to the tens of billions of euros in cuts that Athens was imposing on its citizens. For Greece, the new Merkel-Obama dispensation was revealing itself to be extend and pretend in a new guise. By June, as the S&P ratings agency downgraded Greece to triple C, the lowest score awarded to any sovereign borrower, and spreads surged to 1,300 points, the markets were asking a new question. If the eurozone couldn't handle Greece, what if it faced more serious trouble? What if it had to deal with a crisis in Spain or in Italy? 20 years earlier, in the early 1990s, Italy had been on the rocks. Since then, Italy's debt had stabilized. Rome managed primary surpluses. But its debt was still dangerously high in relation to GDP. And given the size of the Italian economy, the eighth largest in the world by nominal GDP, its debts were enormous, 1.8 trillion euros. Alarmingly, in the last days of June 2011, following the decision to implement PSI in Greece, 100 billion euros of Italian debt had been sold off. European banks were pulling back, with French banks leading the way. The share of foreign holding of Italian debt fell from 50 to 45% in a matter of weeks. That was enough to send Italy's borrowing costs up from 4.25 to 5.54% between June and August of 2011. That might not seem like a large number, but given Italy's huge refinancing needs, it spelled disaster. Between the second half of 2011 and the end of 2014, Rome calculated that it would need to borrow 813 billion euros in refinancing and new loans. A 25% increase in the cost of servicing such a huge volume of debt was a serious matter indeed. If a run began on Italy, it might well be game over for the eurozone. Contrary to North European prejudice, the Italian political class was by no means oblivious to the seriousness of the situation. Italian economists, notably the Bocconi boys, named after the preeminent business school in Milan, had contributed as much as anyone to the new consensus of spending cuts and expansionary austerity. Faced with the emergency of 2008 to 2010, Italy had permitted itself virtually no stimulus. The question was whether Rome had the will and capacity to respond to the new panic in the bond market, and in particular, how Prime Minister Berlusconi would react. Berlusconi was a figure wreathed in scandal. He had faced allegations for crimes including racketeering, large-scale tax evasion, and corruption. But on February 15, 2011, in the most embarrassing charge of all, he had been indicted for paying for sex with a minor and abuse of office in his efforts to cover up his liaison with an exotic dancer and call girl known as Ruby the Heart Stealer. Rather than resigning, Berlusconi clung to his office. On April 6, 2011, as financial markets watched anxiously, Italy's prime minister went on trial. The proceedings were immediately adjourned, but hearings would resume at the end of May. Meanwhile, a dark cloud of uncertainty and disrepute hung over the Italian government. Further doubts were raised at the end of May, when Berlusconi's political alliance between Forza Italia and the Lega Nord lost control of Milan, his personal fiefdom. Even at the best of times, Berlusconi's instincts were those of a crowd-pleaser. Now that he was fighting for his political life, could he be counted on to push through the kind of austerity that his finance minister, Giulio Tremonti, was demanding? Over the weekend of July 9th and 10th, Merkel intervened personally with Berlusconi to urge on him the seriousness of the situation. Europe's future hung on Italy. But was it Italy, or was it in fact Germany that was the weak link? To many in Europe it was unclear whether Merkel herself was truly committed to holding the euro together. Ugly whispers began to circulate that Germany's veteran Chancellor Helmut Kohl, father of the euro and German reunification, was questioning whether his European legacy was safe in Merkel's hands. "This girl, Merkel, is destroying my Europe," Kohl was reported to have told one journalist. Only reluctantly were Merkel and Schäuble persuaded to defer summer travel plans and call an emergency meeting of the European Council on July 21st to discuss eurozone stabilization. The issues were predictable: fiscal adjustment and austerity, PSI, restructuring and debt sustainability, ECB bond buying. Only Europe-wide bank recapitalization, the final element in a coherent crisis containment strategy, was not yet on the table. But what was Berlin's game? Were Merkel and Schäuble engaged in truly hair-raising brinksmanship? Or cocooned in their relative prosperity, did the German political class simply not understand the pressures the rest of the eurozone was under? On July 14, 2011, in response to market pressure, the Italian parliament adopted a severe 70 billion euro austerity program on a par with Germany's 2010 effort. But doubts remained as long as Berlusconi was at the helm, and the issue of PSI in Greece remained unresolved. Trichet was sticking to his guns. If there was anything approaching full-blown restructuring of Greek debt, the ECB would disallow Greek bonds as eligible collateral. Panic was again spreading through eurozone debt markets. What had originally been a problem of small fry like Greece and Ireland was rapidly becoming a comprehensive crisis of southern Europe, including large economies like Spain and Italy. Whereas in 2007, eurozone bond investors had regarded Greek debt as equivalent to that offered by Germany, by September 2011, the CDS spreads on Italy and Spain were higher than those of Egypt in the throes of revolution. The three countries in the world judged most likely to default were all in the eurozone: Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, well ahead of Belarus, Venezuela, and Pakistan. The revolutionary mood seemed to have jumped the Mediterranean. The violent scenes in Athens fed fantasies of social disorder spreading across Europe. Supposedly serious financial analysts were talking of hyperinflation, military coups, and possible civil war. But it wasn't any longer a matter of individual predatory hedge funds or one or two overexcited analysts talking the euro down. Commercial banks and pension funds from across Europe and the United States were pulling tens of billions of euros out of Italy and the program countries. Once eurozone sovereigns lost their standing as issuers of safe assets, institutional investors had no option but to reallocate their portfolios. And that affected the European banks, too. In the summer of 2011, wholesale funding was drying up. With only days to go until the July 21st summit, the possibility dawned on Paris that Merkel might be willing to let the upcoming talks fail. The debt reduction so far agreed with the bank lobbyists was too low to satisfy Berlin. The resources and mandate for the EFSF were insufficient to reassure the French, calm the markets, or persuade Trichet to resume bond buying. If the talks failed, no one would be safe, including France. To break the deadlock, Sarkozy realized that he would have to deal with Merkel one-on-one. The French president arrived in Berlin on July 20th at 5:30 p.m. and immediately hit a roadblock over the EFSF. It soon became clear that Berlin and Paris could not settle the matter without involving Trichet. He was summoned from Frankfurt, arriving on the last plane into Berlin at 10 p.m. The deal had to be done not between Germany and France, but between Germany, France, and the ECB. In the early hours of July 21st, Sarkozy and Merkel took turns on a single cell phone to read out to Van Rompuy, the president of the European Council, the terms of their agreement. That afternoon, in Brussels, the package was formally presented to and voted on by the other governments. Greece would receive an additional €109 billion, meeting its financing needs through 2014 and enabling the IMF to continue as part of the Troika. The interest it paid on its loans would be lowered to 3.5%. Maturities would be extended, and through a menu of PSI options, Greece's creditors would make a contribution, though the precise amount remained to be determined. The ECB would be indemnified for any losses it suffered. If the Greek banks suffered irreparable damage, they would be recapitalized out of Troika funds. Most important, the governments stated emphatically that PSI applied only to Greece. It was the only insolvent Eurozone sovereign. All others would honour their obligations without fail. To contain contagion, the EFSF would be beefed up, and at the behest of the ECB, it would be empowered to enter the secondary market and to establish credit lines for non-programme countries such as Spain and Italy. The EFSF would no longer act only as an ultima ratio, as Merkel had insisted since March 2010, but as a preemptive agency helping to stabilize markets to forestall any threat arising. These, finally, were the elements of a workable solution: buy-in by the Greeks, debt restructuring, further loans, cooperation with the ECB, and backstopping by a newly empowered EFSF. There was even partial recognition of the need for bank recapitalization. The general structure was fine. But did the sums add up? And who was to pay? One neuralgic point was the scale of PSI. The initial figure that had emerged from the polite negotiations with the IIF was only 20%. The bankers were not permitted in the intergovernmental meetings on July 21st, but they gathered in the corridors outside. When the governments let it be known that 20% was insufficient, the IIF offered 21%. With this symbolic concession, there was general satisfaction that a deal had been done. No one did the math. It was a matter of gestures, not arithmetic. When the IMF's representative queried Greece's sustainability under the assumption of such a modest restructuring, the meeting was treated to a furious denunciation by Charles de Lara of the IIF. The indignation, too, was for show. In private, de Lara was only too happy to boast of the astonishingly generous deal that his lobbying had secured for his clients, the big banks. The result of this compromise was that Greece would pay the reputational price for having restructured its debts, but it would gain precious little financial relief. It would be left carrying a debt burden of 143% of GDP, which was clearly unsustainable. As one Goldman Sachs analyst commented, "This tendency to undersize otherwise good policy initiatives has been a recurrent feature of European policies." A member of the UBS economics team was less polite. "This is fiddling around at the margins. The debt needs to halve." As to the new support facilities provided by the EFSF, Willem Buiter, chief economist at Citigroup, told Bloomberg Television, "The European Financial Stability Facility has gone from being a single-barreled gun to a Gatling gun, but with the same amount of ammo. It needs to be increased in size urgently." If Italy went critical, the EFSF would need not 200 to 400 billion, but 1 to 2 trillion euros. Otherwise, only the ECB, with its bottomless supply of euros, could backstop the system. In the meantime, investors were on edge. At the height of July, it emerged that Deutsche Bank had cut its holdings of Italian debt by 88% since the beginning of the year. For Italians in Berlusconi's camp, it was a clear case of blackmail. In the circles around Finance Minister Tremonti, there was talk of a stab in the back. Earlier in the year, Rome had had the temerity to suggest that any joint European bailout fund ought to be funded in proportion not to GDP, but to the size of bank claims that were being rescued. Not surprisingly, this was not a popular idea in Berlin. Tremonti was convinced that the precipitate sales by Deutsche were a message from Merkel and Schäuble. Whatever the truth of the matter, the suspicion was symptomatic. Trust was breaking down. If money was fleeing out of Europe, where was it to go? The answer since the onset of the financial crisis had been, paradoxically, the United States. As U.S. subprime went bad, there had not been the panicked dollar sell-off that many had feared. Instead, investors shifted into U.S. treasuries, the very top of the global monetary pyramid. In 2008, the dollar surged and U.S. interest rates fell. Successive waves of QE reversed that trend. The dollar slid against its major trading partners. This imposed losses on investors and made U.S. bonds marginally less attractive. By the summer of 2011, however, something far more ominous was on the horizon. At the start of the year, as the new Republican majority in Congress flexed its muscles, the effort to craft a bipartisan, long-term approach to fiscal consolidation broke down. For want of a budget, in April 2011, the U.S. federal government already came close to a shutdown. On May 16th, the permissible ceiling of federal debt was reached at $14.3 trillion. With tax revenue covering only 60% of current spending, Washington had hit the limit of its legal right to borrow. The Treasury was forced to adopt extraordinary measures, including borrowing from government cash reserves and selling assets from the Civil Service Retirement Fund. This would see the Treasury through until August 2nd. After that, the U.S. federal government would face a choice between paying salaries or paying its creditors. America was sliding toward something even worse than concerted austerity. A chaotic shutdown risking default on its obligations to both domestic and foreign creditors. In late July 2011, as Sarkozy, Merkel, and Trichet diced with the future of the Eurozone, the United States was perilously close to the edge. There was no longer any disagreement in Washington about the need for urgent fiscal consolidation. But there was a huge divide between Democrats insisting on a balanced approach to deficit reduction, involving tax increases as well as entitlement cuts, and Republicans focused exclusively on spending reductions. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, was looking to assert his control over the Tea Party faction by striking a deal with the White House to achieve deficit cuts of $4 trillion over 10 years. But on July 22nd, the talks between Boehner and the Obama administration broke down over Republican demands for slashing reductions in medical spending and the White House insistence on a $1.2 trillion increase in taxes. Journalists began compiling calendars as to which bills due in August the American government should pay first. Constitutional specialists were debating the pros and cons of executive prerogative, or coining trillion-dollar platinum coins with which to repay the national debt. If Greece was a problem, and Italy was too big to fail, there was simply no reckoning what a U.S. default might do. In August alone, the Treasury had to roll over almost